Once more, we join you from Holden Village to another lecture, and this will be from the Creekside Room in the building called Koinonia. Ted Grosser will be talking and probably discussion on your solutions won't be worth much. So let's tune in on Ted and see what's happening.
I spent a lot of time, particularly in Central America, and one of the stories that I like to tell is that it's probably about 20-some years ago. I think it was Senator Long, whoever was the senator at that particular time from Louisiana, visited Honduras. And as he went through, he came upon a project that some Peace Corps workers and some of my own volunteer teams, because we ran a private Peace Corps at the time, we had built a water wheel that cupped the water and was kind of going, it scooped the water up. It came over to a half hollowed out log, went down and irrigated what could be probably about 5 acres. And it just turned that into really neat, controllable, fertile land, and there were nice crops and so on, and it fed the people. Senator Long was so impressed with this, he went back to Washington just singing its praises as this great creative thing. And I am going back through Honduras probably about 7 or 8 months later, and the head of the aid mission, Tegucigalpa, grabs me and he says, "You have got to help me." And I said, "Now what?" He said, "We've got to find some more sites where we can use this water wheel thing." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, Senator Long went back to Washington, had put a rider on a bill, and we now have funding for 25 sites of water wheels." And we both kind of laughed because there weren't 25 sites for those water wheels in the whole cotton-picking country. I mean, it was just the right kind of water flow, and I'm not a water engineer and so on, but it was just that particular thing worked there, and we found 4 other places in the country. And his dilemma as a good bureaucrat is, I got to turn back the money for 21 of those things, and I hate it. But the fact is we do a whole lot of things on impulse. And we respond to things on impulse, and sometimes it doesn't work. I mentioned that I directed the medical relief after the earthquake. And one of the sadder jobs I had was to go down and, part of the situation we had, this was 1976. In 1972, there had been a monstrous earthquake in Managua, in Nicaragua. In fact, if you go down there today, you can still see the part of the it looks like a trench, but it's where the earth separated and then fell in. And all kinds of stuff poured in from all over the world. And Somoza picked the best stuff. Not a whole lot of it got to people. And then he gathered up all the leftover stuff and warehoused it. 2 years later, there was a horrible, horrible hurricane that hit the coast of Honduras. And one of the first people to respond with great ta-da was Somoza. And he sent all this leftover junk over to Honduras. And the Honduran government was much better than Somoza's. They picked through whatever they could and warehoused the rest and see if they could sell it, you know. In 76, the earthquake came into Guatemala, and the Hondurans sent all this junk over here, okay? At the same time, people were dropping things off at Guatemalan consulates all over the United States. And they literally would drop off couches, they would drop off big boxes of clothes and so on. Things that it cost way more than it was worth to ship it. And one of our problems was, how do we dispose of this stuff without people hearing about it and getting just all outraged at us? Yet the very cost of transporting it was so very, very difficult. And the only way you can really work on such a system like that of gathering in clothing or gathering in blankets and things like that is really through the church, where you don't have any significant overhead. You know, because the lay people grab and do it and so on, and then there's a regional places where in fact it's gathered together by either Lutheran World Relief or Catholic Relief or Church World Service, and they then gather and they sort and they throw out a lot of stuff too. Okay? Because again, it's not worth it. But there are also agencies, and we have people sending medicines, okay? Or you have complications like physicians would fly in on their private planes, land on a complicated main runway in Guatemala City, leave the plane sitting there as they rushed off in Portland to no place, because the hospital was ruined. You know, in fact, it was 6 weeks before we really had the hospital operating rooms up and running again and so on. Which is only to say, I don't want to kill the impulse to do good, but I want to point out that if it isn't well directed, it doesn't help a whole lot. Guatemala, for instance, is a country where Mayan Indians are around, okay? Mayan Indians are on average 5 feet. We got rods for the orthopedic surgeons, okay, that would be put in legs for Americans, okay? And you couldn't saw them off because you contaminated the rod. And so we destroyed them. I had really the sad job of ordering tons and tons and tons of stuff buried because I didn't want the Guatemalan government to ship it to the next disaster in the world, which they would have done, okay? The fact remains is that a whole lot of what happens at times is not really helpful. The other piece is that most relief aid, okay, is very, very short term. And those of us who work in the area say the problem is we are victims of the disaster of the week. Okay? And you think back on how many different disasters have happened throughout the world in the last 12 months. And they get play on the newspaper and so on, and then we move off to the next one. And we really forget that there are people back here absolutely devastated. In Guatemala, where we were working, they were 8 years later, still had not housed all the people who had lost their housing. And so, part of it, and I don't know, does anybody know the difference between relief and development? What is it?
Relief and development would be if a private investor would go in, wouldn't it?
No, not it.
Long term.
Okay, so long term. This is feeding the guy the fish, and this is teaching him how to fish. Okay? Now, rarely can they be separated. And lots of people run around and say, oh boy, yeah, oh, we're just going to be in development. Well, I can tell you from the point of view of our organization, which runs schools and clinics, that if you don't feed the children and make them healthy, sending them to school is a big fat waste of everybody's time and money. They end up retarded and really hurting. And so you can't do what you want to do here, okay? Which is to work for permanent change. One of the philosophical things that I've worked for in our organization is we do not go into, we're primarily a development organization, okay? And do this part only as part of feeding children, or we're asked to. We started out as a organization that worked with refugees out of Vietnam, and so there's still a whole strain of both our supporters and some board members who really feel we need to be responding, okay, to disasters and so on. But I want a 10-year commitment, okay, which means we take much fewer projects, but we focus on them for very long-term periods. And my hope is that we can, in fact, move almost completely away from this onto this. And part of the reason is places like Bosnia, for instance, or Rwanda right now, which are the ones in the news, you need to be so closely connected with the government, okay, or the United Nations, so that you need that so that, in fact, the workers can be protected. And even they lose workers, you know. And if you have a whole lot of private, smaller agencies, the fact is that the troops that are there for peacekeeping can't keep tabs on you, and they can't guarantee anybody's safety. They do a real iffy job at times anyway. Okay. The other part of it is, if you have a budget that you say is going to be 50% relief and 50% development, or 25% relief and 75% development, those figures, if you'll excuse the expression, go to hell in a handbasket the minute there is a major catastrophe for which your constituency has any kind of loyalty. Mm. Okay? And suddenly you're saying, well, we can get back to running schools later. We need to finish this thing here. And you suddenly gut this, fill this, and it's gone. Okay? Because there's very little long-term stuff here. Okay? And one of the real struggles always is, where do you put your money in? From my perspective, it's get yourself into one or the other of these two categories and stay there, ultimately. And that's what we're doing. And we are right now in the process, in fact, of making or redoing all of our stuff into 10-year commitments minimum. And the reason is, if you're going to work for permanent change, you can't be there for a 3 or 5 year grant period, which is what you get most of the time. You're going to have to go for a longer period of time, because otherwise it just doesn't make for permanent change. You've just kind of stirred the pot, and then if you go away at that point, nothing's left. The pot goes back to the way they know it, okay? Or the practices go back to what they have been doing. So part of, and so I'm going to be talking a little bit this afternoon from the perspective of working for permanent solutions, okay? And what I want to do, it sounds as though I'm real pessimistic when I say at this point 75% plus of most projects are of real marginal value. And the reason is, a whole lot of them are still run like the Salvation Army soup kitchen, okay? Which is, you run them in, preach to them, feed them, give them a shower, and maybe you sleep some of them, and then you push them out on the street for the next day. And in the best rescue mission operations, less than 10%, in fact, are either amenable or open or affected by any kind of program of permanent change. And in those rescue mission things, they know that they've got to have that person for at least 2 years. And where they go into, not only do they have to be detoxed, they have to be really retrained and then given some marketable skills, or help to recover marketable skills that they once had before they got into whatever their addiction was. One of the interesting things about working in long-term development is that we have done we've added U.S. projects in some major phases in the last 4 years. And the thing that we've learned is, the stuff we were doing overseas gives us a leg up as we approach things in, let's say, the inner city of Los Angeles, where we're working. And one of the first things is the rule that I give to all my staff people is that you have to listen. And since we're staff training, I have to write listen, 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 listen all over the place. Okay? And the reason is, most people go in assuming they have a solution. That I know what's best for you, you poor beggar, you know, and if you will just listen to my wisdom, you will just be transformed, okay? Mm-hmm. And the truth is,
That ain't the way it works, okay? It really doesn't work that way. And I'll give you one of my favorite stories. We had, some years back, a big grant to set up a model village. We could put in a clinic, we could put in a school, we could put in a road to the Capitol, we could put in, bring in teachers, nurses, small-scale agricultural people, and we could bring in people who could set up cottage industries, or, you know, little things they could do at home or out of their homes. And I was really excited about this thing. We had a bundle of money, and we could bring it to something that would be neat and duplicated in other parts of the world, and I wouldn't be rich, but I'd be famous, you know.
Sounds wonderful. Sure.
Except I'm sitting in Houston, which is where I was office at the time, and I get a call. This was in Honduras, where this project was funded. And our project director called and he said, I got great news, we got a big breakthrough. The village people told us that if we really want to get started, we needed to talk to the women, and that would be the place to start. I said, great. He said, yeah, we had three meetings and we'd come up with the first starting place. I said, what is it? He said, they want us to fence off the cemetery and give them fencing. They want some rakes to clean it up, and they want then some grass seed and so on so they can make the cemetery nice, because the goats and the pigs and the cows are wandering over the cemetery and desecrating the graves of their little ones. And I'm sitting there in Houston, I'm saying, by my quick calculation, you've now spent about $300 out of a multi-$100,000 grant. Where is this going to go? I mean, this is nuts. These people have the chance to do a whole bunch of other things. And he said, trust me, if we don't do this, we aren't going to get any place. We're not going to go any place. Because first of all, lots of people come in and promise all kinds of things, and they don't deliver. Secondly, their vision of what a transformed model village is happens to be focused on a clean graveyard, and that puts them, makes them a first-class village. We just went on and on. And finally, I said, oh, go ahead. You know, what the heck. They may lose this money, but, you know, so what? And the truth of the matter is, we did that. We did win their confidence, and over the next 6 years, in fact, did build a school and a clinic, a road to the Capitol, and ended up with a self-sustaining model that worked very, very well. And I tell you that story because it really illustrates why I really become obsessed with listening. Listening and then starting where they want to start. Huh? Start where they perceive their needs. Huh? And I'll tell you, at least in the work I do, perception is everything. That how people see something, how they understand it, really is everything. And if you think you can change that, try to change the perceptions of someone close to you. Just, you know, think about it, go home and try it, okay? And if you succeed, write me. Okay? I don't expect you will, but I invite you to, because if you work it out real well, we'll make a lot of money. Because changing people's perception is something that everybody needs to try to do at some point. But if you don't start where the people are, it just doesn't happen. And what I want to mention to you before is we're doing this and following these processes in South Central Los Angeles. And it's working. There suddenly, we have identified about 70 groups of people, made up of groups of anywhere from four or five people to as many as 50 people who want to change something. They want to change a school. They want to change, oh, we got a whole big thing going on, closing alleys. that are used for drug deals and all other kinds of messy activities. And the city's helping us tear out all of whatever's left of paving and put in either community gardens, a park with playground stuff for the kids, you know, or gardens, you know, or just neat areas where people can just kind of lounge. And in the middle of the inner city, that becomes a real luxury kind of a thing. We started out with one alley. We succeeded. We now have requests from 60 different neighborhoods to do this, all right? And the big thing is, the next thing is, start out where they are, and you must have local leadership, and ownership. I'm telling you about the South Central thing, so that you don't think I'm just talking about something that happens in a third world country, okay? I think that some of this is really pretty basic human relations kinds of things. Whether you're dealing with your kids, whether you're dealing with your spouse, whether you're dealing with neighbors or coworkers, some of these things are basic rules that we need in all of these. In this particular one, when you have local ownership, that means that it's their project. And it's interesting, in the South Central project, one of the problems we had was we hired a very, very competent African-American woman to run the project. And she knew, or some of the people she was trying to recruit, knew that Children's Aid had a predominantly white Lutheran board, okay? And they said, why should we volunteer for this? You know, you got all kinds of money, if only they knew how little we have sometimes, okay? But they had their own stereotypes. And what we're doing real quick is we are, in fact, incorporating a whole South Central thing with an all African-American board. And then we're going to be trying to expand that to include Latinos, because there happen to be tensions between the Latinos and the blacks, and so on, okay? But if you don't have local leadership and you don't have local ownership, you aren't creating something that's going to last, okay? It will stay there as long as you prop it up and as long as you pump money into it. And one of the things that we face all the time in our particular work is that if you go to a foundation or a government agency or even a corporation, they want to know that their money's going to go in to start something up and that it'll continue after they pull their money out, okay? Now, they're very often very unreasonable. They want to give you $100 and they want you to generate and multiply it into, you know, thousands by some miracle of the loaves or something, okay? but in fact, nobody wants to be constantly subsidizing something. And I may have mentioned to you, but one of the things that we're doing also is, as we go and convert over to areas where we make 10-year commitments or more, we're transferring and shifting most of our programs over into child sponsorship programs. And the reason is, and if anybody's got any voice back in Chicago at the ELCA, take this back to them, because these turkeys are against child sponsorship programs. They say, well, you know, this is all wrong because you're focusing on one child and the rest of the children don't get benefited. And frankly, they don't understand what's going on, okay? If I educate one family in most third world countries, I have elevated the status and the economics of that whole family, because they're not out one each for themselves as we are here in the States. And the other thing we do, for instance, we have a big project among the Karens, okay, in what was South Burma or Myanmar. And we have, I'm just gonna do this here, we got 300 kids sponsored, and each one is chosen and represents another 10, okay? So we really have about 3,000 kids that are in schools in the jungle. And these are the ones who write to sponsors And if the sponsor sends them an extra gift for birthdays or Christmas, they get that. But otherwise, the money goes into a general pool that benefits all the kids in this particular area of the jungle, okay? But because people get personally involved and committed to a child, they said, we have one girl in Indonesia who was sponsored for 16 years, okay? And at the moment her sponsorship began, or not the moment, but 6 weeks before, her father had died. And if it hadn't been for the sponsorship money coming in, her family would have sold her into prostitution to support another mother and the other seven brothers and sisters until the other sisters got older and would have increased the family's economic base. As it was, Priscilla did not have to go through all that. The family avoided that whole business. The sponsor saw that she not only went through, our part of the program was elementary school and high school, but then on to college, where she then went into banking. And the whole family has benefited by that whole thing. That's just one example. But if the sponsor had dropped out or died or whatever, we could have replaced that sponsor and continued supporting that child or this group of children. And I happen to be very excited about it because it's the only area of giving that Yuppies have responded to in the last 10 years, okay? And part of it is because they can see where the money's going. They have the sense, at least, that they have some control over it. There's some direct accountability. And they can touch it when they get the letters and so on.
Who chooses the children?
Local committees choose the children. Well, for instance, in the case of the Koreans, the local tribal folks do, and make, I mean, they're really honored to be writing to Americans, and to get a letter from America is a big time deal. Yeah.
And why is it that the ALCA is a whole, or in a certain committee?
Just this particular, I guess I think they read a critique of it, of particularly World Visions, that was done about 15 years ago, and World Vision has since changed some of the things it was doing. And I just think they're out of date, and they just glom the whole of something, and now they're stuck with the policy.
Out of the 300, actually we should say 3,000, how many missionaries do we have there taking care of this sponsorship?
We don't have any missionaries there, okay? This happens to be
You know, it's Luther money, right?
It's money from all over the place.
Oh, okay.
All over the place. No, Children's Aid is a totally ecumenical organization. Among the Koreans, these are really independent Baptists, okay? In our program in Indonesia, we're working with really the Church of God. In Thailand, we're working with what's called the Union Church.
Church of Christ in Thailand?
Yeah, which is Presbyterians and Methodists and disciples. And Church of Christ. Yeah.
What was the point of critique?
I'm sorry?
What was the point of critique on this program?
What was the criticism?
Yeah.
Okay, the criticism was that if you have four children in a family, okay, and you sponsor just one, it's unfair to the other three. Okay? And I would suggest to you that uses an American model that can't go about 2 inches beyond the borders. Just simply because there's a whole sense of community and family loyalties that we don't understand. We don't understand, for instance, that twice a month in post offices around this country, in quotes, illegal immigrants are lining up to get postal money orders to send home to their families all over the world. And that without that money, those families would be hard-pressed. And the people up here, for instance, Valerie's here from Hong Kong, talking about 100,000 primarily Filipino women. The money that those women are making is absolutely essential to the economy. And we play games. The United States government at times plays games saying we're going to close off the border to people from X, Y, or Z country to put economic pressure on the government. Because, man, they need the hard dollars. They really do. But that's basically the criticism.
There was a very strong, and you probably have seen this, because I think it was what made me refer to, I saw a video program out of England, of the BBC, that was very, very, very critical of, what's that organization?
What, World Vision, you mean?
Yeah. And based on what you said, and it's divisive. You pick up one child in a village and give that person everything, nobody else gets anything, or some organizations would say they only help the Christians, and that's not a very Christian thing to do. And there are ways you can criticize.
Right, but the fact is I'm not aware of one child sponsorship program that I'm aware of, and including World Vision, which is the biggest and probably the most aggressive evangelical organization. They have monstrous programs in Bangladesh, for instance. And you've got to work to find Christians in Bangladesh.
But for the criticism to get out, like what you were saying, you mean they inoculate one child. That's not true.
No, it is absolutely not true.
You can't afford to inoculate one child.
Right.
So, but that's the kind of things that get started.
Well, what we're doing, just hold on for one second. What we do in most cases is, for instance, the health care that is offered to the whole family and very often to the whole community, okay? That where we really focus on a child is in the schooling. And it's just simply one of those terribly difficult decisions that you have to make and say, we only have so much money, so let's pick one child at least from each family. And we do that pretty much. But for instance, in Indonesia, We have an emergency family fund, and a couple of years ago the government came along and widened the railroad track, and it just happened to wipe out all the poor peasants who were living along the railroad track with no compensation or anything like that. And we were able to, about 50 families that were affected were in our program, and we were able to give them money to buy new land and some basic supplies and relocate their housing. And that was kind of a local community decision. We as Americans, or as an American organization, do not get into that. Okay, that's really a local decision. But I also want to say, we do work with Lutheran groups too, but we also work with Catholic groups, particularly in Eastern Europe. We're working with, in Poland, for instance. We're working with Catholics and Eastern Orthodox groups. In Africa, mostly with the African Inland Mission,
huh? How do you work with the Karen, though? Because they're kind of against the government. What's the trade-off with them?
What's this SWAT?
I'll tell you what the trade-off is.
What'd you call it?
Call what?
What'd you just say?
Karen.
The Karen.
Oh, the people.
Yeah, the people. Yeah, the Karens have a very interesting history.
Yes, it takes too long to tell them. It was 35 years of warfare against the Burmese government. I'm curious as to how you're... What's there going to be a trade-off with this?
No, we are totally independent of the government. They come into Thailand, pick up their money and their mail, and so on, and we go back. In fact, there are several border crossings in Thailand where my wife or I signed out of Thailand and never come back again. We came back late at night or something and the guards were gone. But no, it's not all. It's in the South, and we're doing it through what would be kind of the Karen.
We have a Mennonite working in that area who has Karen going back and forth.
It's the only way you can really do it. Yeah. These are people, by the way, who were invited to fight and help the Allies defeat the Japanese. In return, they would be given their own territory and their own country. The Americans withdrew and forgot. The British withdrew and forgot. And they just said, okay. And since World War II, they have been fighting for their freedom. And it is bizarre, because you go into the jungle, and it's pretty deep into the jungle, because then you can watch on mountain sides for miles, the government troops are approaching, they just get up and move. But you go into this big clearing, and here is a big archway in English that says, give me liberty or give me death. And the kids are singing songs that are basically American or British songs in English.
High level of English. fellows.
And committed Christians, deeply committed Christians.
You know why they became Christian?
No, tell me. They wanted to be on the side of the allies.
Very briefly, the Karens had a legend that a white man would come with a Bible. Not with a Bible. A white man would come with a book and bring the truth. And it turned out, wasn't it Judson the Baptist?
Right.
Who reached the Karens, and all of a sudden it was said that the man has come with the book. And they acknowledged that, and thousands became Christian. And so it was a kind of fulfillment of their mythology. And they have been, how they've kept up this English, although they do, of course, Burma was an English colony. But you can meet Karens today in Thailand, who come in illegally, who speak English extremely well. I mean, you'd have no trouble having a conversation.
Well, they teach it.
Yes, and our church has bought books to send up to their camps to teach English to them.
And we send a whole bunch of grammar books every year.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm just curious as to what's the time frame of that? When did this happen? Judson goes back a long ways.
Yeah, this is the 19th century.
Yeah. That's the man who said, the future is as bright as the promises of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I quote him and I'm a Lutheran. Good, what do you see? Do I have to say what he said?
How many are these people in these jungles anyway? How many?
Oh, thousands.
I don't know.
Yeah, thousands. No, it's a regional subset of what was once Burma, called Burma.
Oh. Basically, the mountains are in revolt against the valleys.
Oh. Yeah, right. And they control the valleys. And everything was real fine except the Thais now want to buy all the good wood. And so now the government really wants to take over this land. So it's all economic. And that's why I said the other day, to think that there's a real a good guy, bad guy, or a totally good scenario and set of decisions and a totally bad one is really not the case at all. It's all in this gray area. Yeah.
I had a question about the child sponsorship. Mm-hmm. How do you administrate the funds locally to ensure that the money actually goes to the children? How do you monitor that?
First of all, they send us back statements and so on. And if a sponsor says, I sent, particularly, it's easy to track it with special gifts, okay, because the child is then sending back a thank you note to the sponsor for $25 and we bought this and that. And where that doesn't happen, then we would immediately start looking at the rest of it. But by and large, when we visit and a school is being run and the teachers aren't gathering around saying, I haven't been paid for 6 months, it's pretty much a trust thing. But in every case, we have really pretty sharp people and very trustworthy people, at least from our experience on the ground, who have this great love and dedication for children and who are suffering at times. I mean, we've gone through over the years times when sponsors haven't sent in money and, or donations are down, and people in the field are carrying on and borrowing from Peter to pay Paul until we can pay them back. And so we have a real close relationship.
So the money goes to a local leader who's not a part of your organization, but
what happens is that in most cases, we're supporting part of that person's salary.
Oh, I see.
And most of the people, if we were talking like 17 years ago when Children's Aid started, we would be talking about mostly American missionaries over there. And now it's mostly indigenous people whose local churches are having as much time and trouble adequately supporting them, and so they welcome the extra stuff. But one of the things we need to have as an organization, Children's Aid needs to have, is we need to have someone who is not only a national, but who thinks like an American. Okay, so as far as accountability and planning, and it's a nightmare right now in Eastern Europe. We have a huge program where we are shipping about 10,000 children who are victims of Chernobyl a year out of radiated areas into Poland, into non-radiated areas, and they stay with Polish families, and the families really support them for periods of up to 3 months where they get care, and their immune system begins to work again, and so on. For the first couple of years before the most recent revolution, the government supplied us with a train every month that we filled with kids and go down and back. And they're not doing that now because they're broke and so on, so we're raising money to do that. And I went in to Minsk, the capital of Belarus, and the staff comes and says, we don't have enough money to finish the project. I said, okay, how much money do you need? What do you mean? How much? You know, we need enough to finish. You realize that suddenly it's more than just kind of a language thing, a big cultural thing, and it's going to take them 50 years to figure out how capitalism really works, I mean, as far as accountability and so on. But the thing also is they've got to overcome some things. Like, I asked, well, how in the world did you do this the first 2 years when the government was doing, you know, providing transportation? We would ask for 3 trains, the commissar would give us 2, and we knew that, you know, so we always asked for 3. And I said, what do we do, cut your budget down proportionally? Oh, no, this is different. But it isn't. It's simply because that's what they know. Okay. And you have to then, in this business of local leadership, you really have to build in some internal checks and balances that they enforce. In one of our videos that we have, in fact, that's got a sequence from Thailand up in Chiang Mai, where we were giving them 14 eggs and a can of condensed milk every 2 weeks. To keep the kids healthy and so on as they go to school. And of course, what happened there, what happens every place, is that the next day the market's filled with eggs and condensed milk. And so the local leaders send down a proposal to my wife, who runs our child sponsorship program, and said, what we want to do is we want to make it a rule that you don't get any more eggs unless you come up with 14 empty eggshells and an empty can of condensed milk. And that's what they do. You see these kids counting their eggshells and so on. If Americans had done that, if that had been, you know, a directive from our office to Thailand, man, they'd have beat us up like you wouldn't believe. But because they did it locally, they accept that, and it works. And so you have to have that kind of a thing going constantly. And so a whole major component of what we're doing is a whole lot of leadership training at times and so on. Okay? And then you have to get from them, okay, long-term commitments. And part of the formula there is that you have to be, as an organization, as apolitical as you possibly can be. Because part of getting long-term commitments, particularly if you're dealing in education or public health, you cannot do it without involving the government. And over the years, I've seen other organizations get criticized. I've seen churches get criticized because, oh my word, they're working with, you know, the government of a dictator or something like that. The truth of the matter is, if they didn't, they couldn't help the people. Okay? And one of my great moments of real neat satisfaction came in 1979 when we were working in Nicaragua and we had worked with Somoza's government. We had signed, just before that government fell, a 10-year agreement to continue working and providing public health services. And when Somoza's government fell, I can remember I went over and I just kind of crossed out Nicaragua. And I said, well, that's the end of that for now, because these guys won't. I mean, there was antagonism between the Sandinistas and the American government and so on. And so we pulled everybody out. We had at the time probably about 300 people in there. Pulled them out and sent them to other countries. 6 weeks later, we got some feelers from Mexico and from Argentina and from Spain. saying that they were representing the Sandinista government, and would we honor our agreement that we had signed with the people, not with Somoza's government, it was now with the people of Nicaragua. And I said, yeah, we'll think about it real well, and we will real seriously, but we have to have some direct contact with the Minister of Health. So he calls me at 2:30 in the morning, you know? And we went back in and really set everything up to continue. And we could demonstrate that we were then working with and for the people and not for the government. And I'm real pleased with that, because I think that that demonstrates some very unique and wonderful kinds of things. Also, by being a private organization, you can, in fact, go in where, in fact, there is antagonism with the government in Washington and the government. We worked, for instance, for a number of years in Bolivia at a time when the Bolivian government and the American government were hardly talking because the American government wanted them to wipe out all of the poppies or whatever it is that is used in the drug trade, but never offered a penny to help the campesinos make up for the income they were going to be losing. And we were able to go in and work and so on. And so that on a people-to-people level, I have found very little anti-Americanism. Whereas if you come in as the government, you can get beat up pretty quick sometimes. The thing I really want to go back to is this figure that I threw out before, this very high percentage of risk, or excuse me, of failure. And that means that the thing we talked about yesterday, for those that were here, is that you can't avoid the risk. You really cannot. And I wish everybody here had been in the Bible class this morning, because we talked about the fact that A, risk is real and the result is uncertain, and how do you solve that? And I want to suggest that in the end, the process that you follow is the key, okay? And if the process has integrity, if the process is really done out of the best possible motives that God's people can have, then in a certain sense, you can leave the result in God's hands. If you don't trust the process and you don't have integrity, integrity here, what you end up with is Hitler's wonderful formula that the end justifies the means. And I can manipulate, I can change, I can do whatever I want to do because I am going to do a good thing out here. Okay? And I want to suggest to you that you can't guarantee that just simply because history is against you. And the history of this is a heavy risk, okay? You talk about cross-cultural things here and just listening. What I've learned over the years, if you are an educated national coming out of the capital and you're going into the countryside, you are no more in touch with those people than I am coming from 10,000 miles away in the United States. You live differently. If you're in the capital, you have much more in common with me than you have with the people in the poor countryside. And so that you really have to listen extremely carefully, and the risk of misunderstanding on both sides is real high. Real high. And so you need to, start where they're at, to the point that they even give you solutions that you think are ridiculous, in the example of Honduras. And then really rely on local leadership. I've heard all kinds of criticism, for instance, of medical care in Eastern Europe, and it is bad, okay? Medical care in Eastern Europe is probably 40 years behind the United States, even their hospital buildings. It is really literally like going back to the 50s. And I've toured hospitals where they show me, this is our great incubator for premature babies. Man, the cockpit thing is 50 years old. and it doesn't work all the time. And it's just scary, okay? In fact, I got talked out of a trip because I got a lung infection. And my physician, who's a good friend, was saying, don't go. Don't go. I said, I got to. I've got a bunch of people there. And he says, close your eyes and imagine this. You have an episode, and you're waking up, and a big, burly woman is saying, welcome to the Soviet Union and to our hospital. I said, do you want that to happen? And I said, no. He said, stay home. And I did. Okay. Because I've been in Warsaw, Poland, at a time when they closed down every single maternity hospital because they didn't have rubber gloves. 18 months ago, the city of Moscow had no antibiotics at all, except what they call homemade or Russian-made penicillin. The whole system has broken down because, for instance, the Poles made most of the very high-tech pharmaceuticals. And when the Soviet Union broke up, the Poles, who have no love for Russians anyway, said, listen, you can buy all the pharmaceuticals you want so long as you pay in dollars. And they couldn't pay in dollars, okay? And so that whole system that they had worked out of manufacturing and distributing and everything else is destroyed. And it is a mess. It is a real mess. I visited in December. I was asked to go to Ukraine and visit some hospitals at the far end of Ukraine, furthest, as far as you can get from Russia, right across from the Hungarian border. And first of all, they had this wonderful welcoming ceremony of 50-some degrees. No, it was less than this, about 44 degrees. And I left Wisconsin because I hate the cold. I mean, man. And so I'm standing here freezing as this wind comes off of someplace in Moscow, and thousands of miles later, it's blown on me. They're doing all this great thing because I was the second foreigner, including Russians, who'd been there the last 10 years. And they were really just excited. Okay. And finally came my turn to talk, and I'm saying, I'll tell you what, friends, let's go inside. That is a big lobby. So I went inside. It was 52 degrees. This is a pediatric hospital. 300 beds, okay? And the reason is the Russians had cut off the natural gas and the oil because they wanted hard dollars, okay? And you go, and finally went on this tour of this hospital. They had two x-ray machines that had not worked in the last 2 years, okay? Their equipment was so outmoded and so frighteningly inadequate that I'm looking at it, and people are going on and on about what a wonderful piece of equipment, and the expression on my face must have not been real positive, I guess. Because the head physician took me aside and he said, I know, you know what it's really like. But the rest of the staff doesn't, so please just play along right now. And all they could do for most of the children in this 300-bed hospital was rock them and hold them, and they do a wonderful job of doing that. They really do. But they didn't have enough supplies to do anything. The neat thing is that we have more surplus in this country than we know what to do with. We just need to, and we are getting it organized so it can be shipped over there and do great, positive things. The point I want to really make, though, is that I want to move you back to this head physician. He was well-trained. He knew what they could be doing if they had the right equipment and the right pharmaceuticals. And I'm not certain that that isn't a real modern version of hell, which is to know how things could be and have them just out of reach. Okay? Mm. Constantly out of reach. And it was in places like Poland and Belarus, where so many of the Chernobyl victims are, they don't have the basic stuff for chemotherapy. And they really literally let their children die because they have no choice. And I'm convinced that that alone had more to do with their becoming disillusioned with the Soviet system Because if you can't save our children and work for the future, why ask me to sacrifice now? Because it's not worth it. And it really didn't.
While you were over there, did you see any of the selling off of any of the communist buildings, or did it?
It's a real complicated thing. Okay, privatization is a complicated thing because the very first thing that has to happen is the local workers have to have a crack at buying it, and they can just divide the stock up. And what happens is, if in fact Western companies come over and really start a bidding war, the workers sit back and say, if this is so good, why don't we keep it ourselves? And rightfully so, okay? And so what you have is a whole lot of second and third rate stuff on the market that nobody's really excited to buy, or they're buying so they can buy into the market. The best stuff they're keeping, though. For the workers, and they're dividing it into stock and so on. It's so tough, though. The Soviet Union, or Russia, for instance, gave everybody so many shares of stock in the country that you could, in fact, then trade in and consolidate and so on, and they don't know what to do with it. And so you got some sureties who do know what to do with it going around and just cleaning up, and they're going to control major pieces of industry and business. I don't know what you do about that. I'm not an economist or somebody with an endless bucket of money. The point I want to get to again, though, is that what we've been talking about does not necessarily need to apply just overseas. It really doesn't. It has great application to here. And you can, on the one hand, reduce the risk some. But I don't know if anybody else has got anything else to share on this, but I think that it is real important to focus on the integrity of the process. And by that I mean, is that first and foremost, you weed and sort through your motives as best you can. And nobody's going to have pure motives, okay? Because Jesus himself is not involved in this directly, so the rest of us poor humans need to do something in a less than perfect state. But you've got to have at least some motivations that in fact are motivated by the fact that you're a child of God trying to reach out to others in God's kingdom and in God's world. And then what you do and how you deal with people needs to be done, again, with integrity. We had... I headed a private Peace Corps that sent college and high school and college kids from all over the United States to Latin America. We did it for almost 15 years. And we had to transship stuff over Mexico. If you know anything about Mexico, just driving there can cost you money. Okay? Just because the police are underpaid and they regard graft and bribes the way our waiters and waitresses in restaurants regard tips. You know, it's their just deserve. In 15 years, we did not pay one penny, what's called mordida, okay, or bribes. And that's simply because we just said we weren't going to do that. Now, there are other countries where we did do that, and so I'm not going to sit here or stand here and tell you that, gee, we're just really good guys and know how to do it. No, uh-uh. But we did because Mexico was such a blatant thing that we really just determined we were not going to do it. And we always had at least some high-level official blessing our shipments, and they were worth lots of money because they were, for instance, vaccines and so on that we were shipping. And if we ran up against a roadblock, we turned around and went back. And we wired the official saying, this officer at this place stopped us from helping the people in your country and elsewhere. And most of these poor beggars lost their jobs, okay? But I didn't have too much sympathy, okay? Because my basic thing was to help kids. Get it. In those days, it was running a mass immunization program. But there has to be some real integrity in the process. And I think for Americans, this is tough. I really do. Because we judge everything by, you know, success here or failure here. And if it isn't going to be a success, we don't want to do it.
Okay.
And doing the job well and trusting the outcome is something we find really, really difficult. And the older I get and the further I get along on my own journey of faith, the more I'm convinced that's probably the way I'm going to end up living all of my life. Okay? Which is trusting the process, trusting the relationships, trusting my ability and my understanding of God's will for me, and then moving forward and letting the end result to be His. As I said the other day, one of the great comforts for me is to be reminded every once in a while, sometimes real brutally, that it's God's world, not mine. You know, and he's the one who has the whole thing in His hand, and I don't. And we get one of my favorite examples that I use often is that what we get screwed up and mixed up is if this is the Creator and this is the created, we constantly want to turn this thing over. Okay? We want the created to act like the Creator. And we really want the created, or the Creator, God, to act like a puppet, does what we want him to do. And I don't know about your experience, but mine is he keeps going, this is the way it's supposed to be. You know. Anybody have any comments or questions?
I've got a question for
you.
Yeah? I come up with this wild idea here about 8-9 months ago.
Which one was that?
About setting up some mobile units for the people, you know, we see them on TV, the people that live under overpasses and that are standing next to a 55-gallon drum in the big city, you know, with a fire going to stay warm. Mobile housing, where their housing is in kind of a circular position, and then they have one bathroom in the center to service all of these individuals, and they're on skids.